Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Obama looking for a speech that will turn things around.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union.
221 years ago.
In a hall that still stands across the street, a group of men gathered and with these simple words
launched America's improbable experiment
in democracy.
2 years ago, an improbable candidate, Barack Obama, gave a lofty speech on race that still echoes in the hearts and voices of young people like that 9-year-old boy. This week, Obama's looking for lofty and his best presidential voice on the dirty details of Washington politics.
In order to form a more perfect union.
Needing a more or less perfect State of the Union speech on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, January 26th, and The Takeaway is kind of a question. Does Obama's well-polished, lofty voice of rhetoric serve him well in this State of the Union challenge on Wednesday?
We'll have to find out, but if you're betting on somebody to give a really, really good speech that resonates, I would usually bet on Barack Obama.
That seems indeed
to be his specialty. Let's get right to the top stories this morning. With his first State of the Union address tomorrow night, the president continues his full-court economic press.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
Yesterday, we told you about his package to help middle-class families. Today, we're learning President Obama will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs for 3 years. The Pentagon, veterans programs, foreign aid, and homeland security would all be exempt. Also in the speech, the president's expected to call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military.
The State of the Union speech gives the president a chance to jumpstart his agenda, which has suffered political setbacks recently. Still, as the president tells ABC News, he's determined to push forward.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
Yikes, a really good one-term president. Bill Rice joins us now, a reporter for WCPN in Ohio, where the president was talking about jobs late last week. Bill, the president ran on a campaign issue of change in America. Are voters in Ohio changing their views of the president?
Well, John, the president's poll numbers are turning against him in some quarters in Ohio, in some areas more than in others. Ohio's a state that's been hit very hard by the recession, and many people here are still not seeing the way out.
All right, well, we're going to probe some of the sort of change-making voters there in Ohio. Stay with us. Bill Rice is a reporter for WCPN in Ohio.
Ben Bernanke appears headed for another 4 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Senator Richard Durbin says opposition on Capitol Hill has petered out.
I do believe that we're moving forward, and with Republican support, this nomination will be approved.
The Senate's expected to vote on Bernanke's confirmation this week. As for the health care bill, congressional Democrats are rallying around their last best hope, which is passing the Senate bill with some changes to accommodate House Democrats. It's unclear, though, if they'll have the votes for it. And in Haiti, the United Nations says up to 1 million people need shelter, and there's an urgent need for at least 200,000 tents. In a move to show solidarity with earthquake victims, Haiti's president plans to move into a tent on the lawn of his collapsed National Palace.
In Iraq this morning, a suicide car bomber killed at least 18 and injured dozens. Here at home, nearly 1 in 5 Americans said they didn't have the money to buy the food they needed at some point last year. The national survey found more than 38 million Americans, 1 out of every 8, now receive food stamps. That's a record high. Asian and European markets down, futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,196, the S&P at 1,096, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,210. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about your work life. Does taking a vacation at work sound like a good idea? It might be a career change option.
We're also looking ahead to the president's State of the Union address, and we're asking not just our guests, but you, too. What do you think is the State of the Union? Do you think you can give us your State of the Union in 6 words? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, a pulse from voters.
Good morning, everyone. So fresh from the political wounds of that setback in Massachusetts last week, the president went off to Lorain, Ohio at the end of the week and talked about jobs and showcased some of the rhetoric we're likely to see in the State of the Union address later on this week. All about jobs in the middle of the recession. Northeast Ohio has an unemployment rate upwards of 10%. The entire state of Ohio's unemployment rate is 10.8%. Joining us to figure out where voters are and where they're likely to be between now and the off-year election in November of 2010 is Bill Rice, reporter and associate editor of news at WCPN in Ohio. You're there in the Idea Stream Mothership building there in downtown Cleveland, right, Bill?
Indeed.
All right. Good morning to you once again. And Jason Johnson is a professor of political science and a board member of the Garfield Institute for Public Leadership at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio. Good morning, Professor.
Glad to be here.
So, Bill, let me play you a couple of voices here of voters that you've been sort of exploring the psyches of, the pulses of on your programming ever since the president visited last week. And I want to sort of probe whether there's any demographic significance to these two very, very different positions on how Obama is doing. Listen.
I think he's doing okay. You know, we had a crisis on our hands, and I think he dealt with that as best as he could. I think, he had to make decisions, split-second decisions, and I think you can't fault him for some of the mistakes he may have made. Looking back, but considering the dilemma we're in, I think he did a good job.
I'm not impressed at all. I think that he's spending in places that I don't agree with the health care bill. That could be the destruction of our whole health care system, in my opinion. For businesses like ourselves, small businesses, it's just scary. Some of the things in there that are proposed are just very scary for our future and for a younger generation future especially.
Now, there's nothing scientific about those two voters, and their positions seem fairly well polarized. Bill, first of all, who do they represent, and where are the change makers in the Ohio electorate that are likely to be moving between now and November of 2010?
Well, for one thing, those people represent people who have jobs, and there are plentiful numbers of people here in Ohio that don't. One of those I recorded myself. He was at a business luncheon last week, and he's a white collar worker, and presumably his job is fairly safe. And his view reflects what you hear from a lot of people around here: is that the president did inherit a boondoggle of an economic situation. And you have to give him time to try to put in the policies to try to rectify that. This other gentleman, I presume he has a job just the way he speaks. I think he represents those independent voters that you hear about, people who may at one point have been in the Republican camp, were swayed by Obama's by the president's rhetoric during his campaign and convinced to vote for him, and now is feeling a little bit disillusioned, especially with the fight that we've seen over many, many months over health care in Washington.
All right, so two polarized people who apparently have jobs. Jason Johnson, let's talk about all the people in Ohio who don't have jobs. Listen to the president's rhetoric last week in Lorain, Ohio, at the community college. It's in some sense predictable rhetoric, but I'm wondering if in the venue where he was speaking, it actually works. Listen.
I won't stop fighting for an economy where hard work is rewarded. I won't stop fighting to make sure there's accountability in our financial system. I'm not going to stop fighting until we have jobs for everybody.
Is there kind of a high risk, Jason Johnson, in that kind of rhetoric? Because Barack Obama's not going to get anybody a job between now and November, necessarily.
Right. And it sounds a lot like John Edwards, actually, when he was running during the campaign in 2008. He's going to fight, he's going to fight, he's going to fight. I don't think anyone doubts that Barack Obama actually cares about the job issue. I think the concern is people just want to see the jobs appear.
Right.
And I think in an area like Lorain, you know, you can talk about all that you want to do and all that you want to fight, but it's not also just bringing jobs. This is a part of the country that's been economically depressed for over 15 years. What kinds of jobs are you going to bring? Is it going to be construction? Is it going to be computers? Is it going to be the kind of thing that requires training? I think Obama needs to get more specific when he's in places like Northeast Ohio, because just saying jobs alone is not going to cut it.
So Jason Johnson, and you're a professor of political science at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio, does it play as flailing around then to not be specific?
it's not so much that it's flailing around. It's just people are waiting for the results. People are concerned about what kinds of employment is going to come through. There have been improvements. In Lordstown, Ohio, there are factories that have actually added new shifts. Some of the stimulus package money has worked in Columbus, Ohio, as far as repaving and working on roads. But the fact of the matter is there was a large undercurrent of people in the state who really, really felt locked out of the economy over the last 8 years. They voted for Obama and Ted Strickland, the governor, because they thought that they were going to improve things, and they haven't seen anything yet. And by this November, they may be tired and looking for a change.
So Jason Johnson is describing that a clock is ticking. It's a political clock, and I think Susie's wearing that clock on her wrist. Listen.
I think he's doing the best that he can, considering what he walked into. You know, he walked into a mess, so you've got to give him time.
Bill Rice, that's another one of your voters. How much time do you think Obama has in Ohio?
Well, in Ohio, I think he's got a conservative tide running against him at this point. Again, those independent voters, many of whom do have jobs, some of who don't, but are very prominent in southern parts of the state, are going to make the case that this is not the change that they voted for. This is not the change that those people without jobs voted for, and maybe some of those people will either not show up when it comes time to vote or vote the other way.
Wow, that's a bleak picture. Jason Johnson, before we go, does this talk of freezing spending, dealing with the deficit, reach the independents who are part of this conservative tide that Bill Rice is talking about?
The independents who have jobs love hearing that. The independents who are at home because they haven't found work, they don't care about a freeze in funding. They just want to find out when the jobs are going to be available. They want to find out if they're going to lose their unemployment benefits. They want to find out if spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week looking for a job is actually going to result in something effective. I think Obama's got quite a bit of time as far as his overall administration, but he may not have much time between January's State of the Union address and the November elections.
Well, Ohio voters looking for specifics on both sides of the aisle there in the upcoming State of the Union address. Jason Johnson, thanks so much. Professor of Political Science at Hiram College in Northeast Ohio. And Bill Rice, reporter and associate editor of news at WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks to both of you. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following.
An independent investigator is launching two probes into the government's rescue of AIG. The first will look at whether the Fed withheld documents requested during an audit. The second, into emails from Fed attorneys telling AIG to withhold certain details of the rescue from the Securities and Exchange Commission. President Obama is gearing up for his first State of the Union address. So far this week, he's been focused on the economy. Yesterday, he addressed the struggles of regular Americans.
Unfortunately, the middle class has been under assault for a long time. Too many Americans have known their own painful recessions long before any economist declared that there was a recession.
And last night on ABC, the president joked about what he would have told his former self about the year ahead.
You're going to look older in a year. You've got more gray.
And he'll be sporting that gray when he speaks tomorrow before a joint session of Congress in the State of the Union address. His speech is expected to have tighter rules for Wall Street. It will propose a job creation push and lift the ban on gays in the military. Finally, a new study suggests that young girls may learn to fear math from their teachers. Here's University of Chicago study author Shion Bylock.
What we're showing is that girls and boys, at least some of them, are aware of these stereotypes early on, and for girls at the end of the year who endorse these stereotypes, they're more likely to perform poorly in math.
The study says young students model themselves after adults in the same sex, and female teachers who are anxious about their own math skills may be passing it on to female students.
As a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning, coming up, who's going to take over the concert ticket selling business and the big merger coming?
Hey, you want that to go?
Get your news takeouts. Here in the studio is Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times, and Todd Zwillick down in Washington. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
So I'm confused, Todd Zwillick. In the middle of a recession, in the middle of talk in Washington about a second stimulus package, Obama is apparently going to roll out a positively Nixonian-sounding domestic spending freeze. What's going on?
Well, it smacks of fiscal responsibility, doesn't it? Freezing all increases in discretionary spending across the government. Now, this is on government programs except at the VA, which is health care and housing for veterans, DHS, which is Homeland Security, and of course, defense. Nobody wants to mess with that.
It sounds like an almost a Reagan kind of a program, and we're going to hear about it specifically in the State of the Union address, right? Is he trying to appeal specifically to conservative Democrats and Republicans?
I think he's trying to appeal to all those people, but also independents who were, you know, I hate this phrase, I'm sorry, game changers, but who were the game changers in Massachusetts, and they're afraid.
Were they the game changers in Massachusetts, Todd?
They were the game changers in Massachusetts, but maybe across the country. But on this domestic spending freeze, it's really unclear how this is going to work. Don't forget, spending is only one side of the equation in deficits. Revenue is the other side. And unless tax revenue goes up and business improves, cutting spending doesn't really improve the bottom line as much. It's a two-sided coin. Also, this is just a presidential proposal, John. It's up to Congress to decide how much to spend. And their power under Article 1 of the Constitution is in spending money. They don't like to have it curtailed. And the other thing I should point out, that discretionary spending, freezing it, is great. It's going to be politically popular and does help with the deficit. It's not where the real money is. The real money is in the entitlements. Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, and defense, none of those is included in this proposal. That's where the big money is in the long term.
All right, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Maybe we'll see some specific numbers tomorrow night. Thanks.
Definitely not a spending freeze in the world of music. Yesterday, the U.S. Justice Department cleared the way for a huge merger between two of the world's biggest concert promoters. And Louise Story, our partner from the New York Times, is here to explain it to us. Who's merging?
So we've got Live Nation. You know, they're a giant concert promoter. And Ticketmaster, which is the biggest ticket selling and artist management company. And what's interesting is, you know, Ticketmaster has been around from the 70s. They've been reviled off and on by artists. You probably remember Pearl Jam in the 1990s,
right.
You know, taking a case to the DOJ because they wanted to sell tickets under $20. But of course, Ticketmaster didn't want that. And Live Nation has been more of an upstart. So now you've got the upstart joining the Goliath. It's a merger that Bruce Springsteen has warned is a near monopoly. But the problem is, it's a vertical integration. That's in business where you take the whole pipeline process and merge it rather than direct competitors. And it's much more difficult for the DOJ to fight cases against vertical integration.
Meaning that they're not duplicating services.
That's right.
Right. They're just more
They're
on
handling
the chain.
Different parts of the music production, music concert situation. So what the Department of Justice has done is imposed some rules on them about this merger. They've said, for instance, that this merged company cannot punish venues if they, for instance, don't use them for concert promotion but want to use one of their artists. They can't do that. They can't share data between divisions. So they've just put some restrictions on.
You know, Celeste, what do you think? You think Louise is a Pearl Jam fan?
Oh, yeah.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think? Louise?
You know, I think I prefer Madonna, who is a Live Nation artist. I kind of have a soft spot there for those 80s hits.
And she's quite the businesswoman also.
She is quite the
businesswoman. That's right, correct.
Louise Story, thanks so much. Business and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
So in yesterday's show, we talked with two doctors about the provocative question of whether the experience of childhood sexual abuse is traumatic to the victim and exactly when. It got this listener thinking about an event in her own life.
This is Colette. When I was younger, I visited my family doctor, and he touched me inappropriately. The interesting thing was, I didn't realize it until years later that what he did was wrong, but I'm not traumatized by the event. I knew then something wasn't quite right, but, you know, it happened, and I'm like, you know, that wasn't right, but it hasn't affected me. So, you know, I just think this discussion of whether, you know, something is trauma at the time or trauma upon recognition of the event not being appropriate is interesting and relevant.
Indeed. Colette didn't tell us if she ever reported the incident with the doctor, aside from mentioning it to us. But Clancy, another listener, told us the whole issue is getting young people to report and not traumatizing them about their disclosures.
I completely understand the importance of calling this event a trauma from sort of the adult perspective. But the problem is that because of our positioning the event as trauma, but not clarifying details of the event, you end up with a lot of people out there who never report the sexual abuse to anyone and who themselves don't necessarily feel like they were victims because their understanding of the event was when it happened, it was not traumatic.
Wow. Hi, this is Megan calling from Detroit, Michigan, and I have to say I'm horrified by assertions that some child sexual abuse victims are not traumatized by what happens to them. I agree that child sexual abuse creates a wide range of different reactions in many different people, but to say that it is not inherently traumatic when someone close to you breaks your trust and abuses you is disturbing, to say the least.
Well, we suspected we would get responses to our discussion of child abuse yesterday. Thanks for that, Megan. And you can listen to the podcast of yesterday's segment and hear Dr. Clancy talking about her theory at thetakeaway.org.
Thanks to all of you for your takes and your stories. We want to hear about you, about anything that you hear that touches a nerve. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, in the midst of the Haiti coverage, maybe you felt like this listener.
Not about news, it's about what sells and what can be used to excite people, and most of all, what can be used to scare people.
We're going to be talking about some of the graphic images coming out from the streets of Haiti. Have you seen some of these photo essays,
Jen? Indeed.
I had to stop looking at some of them. I mean, I understand some people's reluctance or, I guess, distaste about some of the images, but do they have real news value?
Well, tough calls for photographers, that's for sure.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about that more in just a few minutes. Coming up, you've probably seen a lot of photos or videos coming out of Haiti, and maybe some of them were too graphic for your taste. Maybe not. Have they helped you get a handle on the situation? We're going to talk about the news effect of some of these images in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A day ahead of his first State of the Union address, President Obama tells ABC News he's not concerned about the dip in his approval rating.
When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached.
In tomorrow night's speech, the president's expected to ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs, as well as call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military. One thing he will not ask for, tax hikes.
I haven't raised taxes on anybody. I've cut taxes. 95% of working Americans have gotten a tax cut.
The president delivers his first State of the Union tomorrow, and we're asking you to give us yours. Can you describe the State of the Union in 6 words or less? Some of our listeners have been very creative with this. Do that. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org.
In Haiti, desperation boiled over at the wrecked National Palace. United Nations peacekeepers had to fire pepper spray into the air yesterday to disperse a crowd of thousands jostling for food. Lieutenant General Ken Keane says the U.S. military hasn't had any problems, though, with the Haitian people.
There have been no security incidents that have impacted our ability to deliver aid, and there has been no incidents against any of the U.S. forces in our as we go out and do our job.
The Archdiocese of Miami is drafting a plan to fly hundreds, maybe thousands, of orphaned Haitian children to South Florida. The plan is called Pierre Pan, after the Pedro Pan flights in the 1960s, when Cubans opposed to the revolution sent 15,000 children to the U.S. China is warning the U.S. this morning that an upcoming arms sale to Taiwan will further damage relations. The sale does not include F-16 fighter jets coveted by Taiwan. And General Motors will announce today it plans to build electric motors for future hybrid cars and trucks, the first U.S. automaker to make them in-house. So let's check the markets then. Asian and European markets down. Futures are down, so Wall Street will get underway on the negative side at 10,196. The S&P opens at 1,096 and the NASDAQ at 2,210. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
For 2 weeks, we've been bombarded with photos and video of the devastation in Haiti. I was looking through a photo essay on the web with pictures of corpses in the streets and horribly injured survivors, and I had to ask myself, are some of these images too graphic? Do they exploit the people and the culture that they represent? We're joined now by Paul Taggart. He faces these questions every day in his job as a photojournalist. He's been covering Haiti since the earthquake hit, and he's currently in the Dominican Republic, but is returning to Haiti soon. And Kenneth Irby joins us as well, leader of the Visual Journalism Group at the Poynter Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Paul, we've featured some of your photos from Haiti on our website. Can you tell me about some of the more striking pictures that you've taken?
One of the stories we worked on in that first week of coverage was following a man named Mompazir Nazil, who's a 56-year-old man who volunteered on the first day after the quake to collect bodies in the street. which is both, you know, medically important to get these off the street, is also just for the mentality of the people. So I ended up following him for 3 or 4 days over the last week and a half. And so some of those images are rather graphic, but I think in the context of following this volunteer Haitian, it's more of a rounded out story, but pretty dramatic stuff.
So you face this particular issue every day as you bring a shot into your lens, and you have to consider whether to take a photo or not. You're getting paid for your work. Do you ever feel like you're exploiting the subjects of your photos?
No, I don't. I mean, I wouldn't take a picture if I thought that I was. Just like any job or anybody doing anything, I think we have an inherent sort of understanding of morality, and I'm not going to do something just because I have a camera that I wouldn't do otherwise. And as far as like deciding to take a picture or not take a picture, I usually lean on the side of taking the picture. Whether I file it or not is a different story, and whether an editor uses it in the context in which they use it is something to keep an eye on and keep track of. So I think that's more important of how the image is used, where it's used in the context of it, than whether you actually take the photograph or not.
Okay, I want you both to listen to this phone call from one of our listeners.
The name is Tim, calling from Denver, Colorado. It's degenerated a little bit into the balloon boy deal. A lot of the media is like that nowadays. It's not about news. It's about what sells and what can be used to excite people, and most of all, what can be used to scare people.
Kenny, you're not just you don't just work at the Poynter Institute, but you yourself were a photographer. Do you think that the images out of Haiti are used to excite people or scare them?
No, absolutely not, Celeste. I think that the images that I've seen have been a valiant and purposeful attempt to help inform society, particularly we're talking about American coverage, about a very traumatic and sad reality that's happened to our neighbors, not far from us. And the photographs, as we were just hearing from Paul, have brought a vicarious perspective that people need to be able to visualize in order to understand the magnitude of the tragedy there.
But in your duties, what do you think is going too far? What kind of guidelines do you give to photographers to say, take this photo but not this one?
Oh, well, the guidelines, the first thing you have to understand is that the photojournalists are human beings first and not robots. And, you know, their guiding principle as journalists working for media organizations and independently those like Paul as well, I mean, their guiding principles are to maximize truth-telling. We teach there are guidelines in place to seek and report the fullest truth possible and also to be compassionate and thoughtful in terms of minimizing harm. So there are guidelines in place for journalists to govern them. The bigger problem, I think, is not the principles of the journalists, it's the ignorance of the American people. The American people have been protected, sheltered, and privileged and don't want to see the kinds of realities that are happening outside of our borders and to take a responsibility that we have as Americans to help those that are in need.
Although, Kenneth and Paul, you can weigh in as well. When my kids look at a picture like that, they don't think about Haiti. They think about just the person who died, the one person who died. In an earthquake that's the biggest in 200 years, do people of Haiti and corpses in Haiti lose their private rights and become public figures, in a sense, in the pursuit of a historic news story, Kenneth?
Absolutely. I think we've seen that not just only in Haiti. We've seen that in America in 9/11 and the Oklahoma City bombing. There have been situations even on our own soil where the news magnitude supersedes individual privacy. Now, that happens because of the news and the news value and the historic value. But journalists are taught to always seek to preserve the dignity of the bereaved, of the deceased, and the survivors that are there. And I think these photographs, as you alluded to in the lead-in, there are some things that journalists see for the purpose of helping the democracy and the society understand the proportions that they don't share. And so there's a thoughtful process of what should be what's shared and where that line is. And that line is a fine line, and it is relative to the society. Now, today we see far more horrific stuff, and children see far more horrific stuff in the video games and movies. And this is truthful reality that we need to be having the conversations with our children about.
Right.
And that's one of the things that a lot of parents don't want to do.
Kenneth Irby is the leader of the Visual Journalism Group at the Poynter Institute. Paul Taggart is a photojournalist covering Haiti, heading back there this week. What do you think? Do you think the photos from Haiti have been exploitative, or have they helped you appreciate the gravity of the situation? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or at our new website, thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And joining us now is the swashbuckling, dashing old friend of mine, Hugh Schofield, BBC correspondent in Paris. Good morning, Hugh.
Well, thank you very much, John.
It's great to hear your voice once again.
Yeah, and likewise.
Let's talk about this serious story in France. A parliamentary commission this morning has recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in public service facilities such as hospitals, schools, and public transport. The French have already banned such garments in state schools. Where is this likely to go, and how controversial is it?
It's likely to come into law. I mean, as you say, this is a first step. It's a parliamentary committee, so nothing's going to happen straight away. And there's going to be a long gap now because we've got elections coming up, and they don't want to push this through before those regional elections in March. But, there is political impetus behind this, and it seems to me more than likely that this law, which falls short of a full ban on the full veil, will come into effect probably, I don't know, later on this year. But it is controversial. Controversial in the sense that many people think that this is not enough. There's probably a majority of people who are saying in France they do want a complete ban on the full veil, the sort of wraparound face covering veil. But there are also people who, of course, take completely the opposite view and say this is the government legislating on something which it has no business legislating on, and that it's cracking a nut with a very large sledgehammer, which is going to cause all sorts of problems for community relations.
Well, Hugh, listen to the voice of this French Muslim woman, Nora Rami.
I think that personally, as far as I'm concerned as a Muslim, I don't think it's religious obligation, so I have a few problems with it. But at the same time, I don't think that banning the wearing of niqab will be the solution to the problem.
What is the remind us of the problem that she's referring to, and why a majority think it's disruptive for Muslim women to wear observant clothing in public?
You've got to remember two things. One, France is a country with a very, very strong, one could almost say radical secular tradition, which feels absolutely no compunction because of its sense of self and the revolutionary past. Has no compunction at all about insisting on a secular public lifestyle. It feels it had a long battle of the Christian church back, which only ended 100 years ago or less. There's a common feeling that a battle, a new front line has opened up in which the state, the secular state, has to assert itself. On the other hand, there is evidence, anecdotal evidence, but I mean, from my eyes, in my neighbourhood, I see it happening the all encompassing veil is appearing. I mean, it's very, very rare and marginal still, but 5 years ago you never saw it in France. Now you do see it, and that offends certain people, not just women, but also many people who are very attached to France and its republic.
Indeed.
So we've had a bit of it's all come together, and now there's this great pressure to do something.
Well, change is afoot, and we're talking about it this morning, the possibility that French women will not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in public service facilities such as hospitals, schools, and public transport. Talking with Hugh Schofield. Hugh, if I come to Paris, can I crash at your place?
Yeah, no problem.
You know, I got five kids now.
Well, I've still got your book on my shelf.
All right. Hugh Schofield.
Yeah, remember that one?
BBC correspondent. Yes, indeed. Thanks.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, it's Tuesday. We're going to be talking about work. And what do you think? If you had a week's vacation, would you spend it at your work? Maybe not, but we're going to talk about some people who want to spend their vacation time at other people's jobs. That's in a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. As the president gets ready for his first State of the Union address tomorrow, he tells ABC News he's focused on being effective, not securing a second term.
There's a tendency in Washington to think that our job description of elected officials is to get reelected.
But he says politicians should aspire to more.
That's not our job description. Our job description is to solve problems and to help people.
Tomorrow's address will focus on the middle class, including a tax credit for small businesses that add employees and $150 billion in additional stimulus spending to spur job creation. We want to get your take on this, too. What is the state of our union? Think you can describe it in just six words?
This is Brandon from Oklahoma City. I'm going to try the six words. How about, our system is broken. Communism works.
Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
From Oklahoma, too.
Interesting. Yeah, wow.
Yes, the wind power industry grew at a breakneck speed, in 2009, adding nearly 40% more capacity. Right now, about 2% of our electricity comes from wind turbines. And on energy news, oil prices are down to around $74 a barrel today, a monthly low. The BBC's business reporter, Duncan Bartlett, is here to talk about it. Good morning, Duncan.
Good morning.
I'm looking at, $74.49 trading that I'm seeing here in New York. What explains this drop from almost $84, I believe, less than a few weeks ago?
Well, the loss that we've seen overnight, which is about a fall of about a dollar a barrel in terms of the price of crude oil, is really down to China. Now, the United States consumes far more oil than any other country in the world, but China comes a close second. And with the Chinese economy growing, the country's been buying more and more oil to sustain its industry and all those new cars that are on the road. In fact, we recently just saw that the Chinese economy is growing at about 11%. But what's happening now is the government is concerned it might be growing too far, too fast. It's trying to rein in the amount of money which is being lent by the banks. And the concern there would be for the oil traders that means that China's immediate demand of oil is going to go down.
Duncan Bartlett from our partner, the BBC, talking about oil prices. So China's concern about inflation possibly gets oil traders selling, and oil is down to about $74 a barrel. In other news, the pregnancy rate among teenage girls jumped 3% for the first time since 1990. The abortion rate also inched up. Big upset at the Australian Open this morning. Defending champ Rafael Nadal is out after a knee injury during the quarterfinals against Andy Murray. And finally, one down, more than 309 million to go. The U.S. Census began the 2010 count of the nation's residents in an Arctic village yesterday. The first person tallied was Clifton Jackson, the eldest resident in an Alaskan Eskimo community. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It is time to talk about work here on The Takeaway. Today's topic, vocation vacation. So that means a vacation where you work, but at somebody else's job. Many of you are thinking, why on earth would I want to work when I finally get some vacation days? Beth Kobliner, our work contributor, has some reasons, and I hope they're good ones, Beth, on why we would want to do that.
Promise.
We're also joined by Mike Leonard. He's a former vocation vacationer. He joins us from Washington, D.C., about how it led him down a new career path. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Beth, what is a vocation vacation?
It's basically a temporary position in an out-of-town location that you can offer, that can offer you work experience. So, and sometimes you actually pay to work. And other times you can be paid to work. But if you're looking for a job right now and you're hoping to switch, this is something to consider, you know, in the context of the fact that right now unemployment is at 10%. Huge number of people who have jobs who are not happy with their jobs. The Conference Board just released a study showing that unhappiness at jobs are at the highest level in 22 years. People are staying unemployed for, on average, 8 months. That's 10 weeks longer than it was a year ago. So given all that, a vacation is sort of like we've talked before about internships or seasonal jobs. It basically offers you a chance to get some foot in the door for a job or for work for a week or two.
Here's the thing,
yeah.
Though.
I knew you guys were going to be
skeptical. I can't sit in for a brain surgeon, though, right?
Yeah. But no. Here's the thing, Beth. If you're unemployed, you know, the number one a vocation vacation mate probably doesn't help. I don't think that, you know, the vocation thing will will help that. I mean, there's just a huge unemployment rate in the United States. The other thing is that how are you going to have the money
right
to pay to go work somebody else's job?
Well, I knew you were going to say that. And, you know, honestly, when I first heard this topic, I thought that, you know, and everybody thinks of those as those frivolous vacations that either, you know, wealthy parents send their teenagers who are bored, you know, right. to work and, you know, build
or
huts
some
in
bored
countries.
Retired person. Or,
exactly. But actually, these are now growing in interest because, first of all, you can do it for less money. You can do it for under $300. There are good places like, you know, if you're at a situation where you don't have a job, you can't get a job, and you've always wanted to try something else. And we have Mike here who's going to be talking a little bit about his situation. But there's, you know, coloradotrail.org or wildernessvolunteers.org. And we'll put all these on the website. There are places you can go for less than $300. There are lots of different websites offering a lot of opportunities that give you 2 weeks of working in a totally different field that may not lead to a permanent job, absolutely. But it could open your mind and make you think about creative possibilities. You know, there was one woman I spoke with who worked in a bake shop, and then eventually it led her to opening her own bake shop.
Okay, so Mike Leonard, you're now a program analyst with the Department of Energy. What vacation did you take?
Well, let's see. I was a freshman in college walking around Boston and stumbled upon a brochure in an outdoor store for an organization called Wilderness Volunteers that runs backcountry service trips throughout the country. So that entails everything from trail building, trail maintenance, campsite restoration, fence removal in the national parks, national forests, wilderness areas. And we work with federal agencies that need the help.
So but isn't this just
New Mexico.
Isn't this just you paying them for volunteer work? To do volunteer work?
Some people see it that way. It is, in a sense, you donating your free time to do some work. But on the flip side,
sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Well, my friends all think I'm crazy.
But Mike, the interesting thing about Mike's story was he was talking about how he was, you know, an economics major on the track to being, you know, banking. Now this is about how many 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when everybody was going into these fields, or a lot of people were going into these fields, and what it did was broaden an interest for him and got him very interested in environmental interest areas, which has led to his career at the energy department.
Oh.
So what I'm saying is it opens people horizons. And in this particular economy, I think we have to think creatively. And I think a lot of people, it's very upsetting. And I'm saying that for the $200 vacation, that might be something that opens, you know, gives you a little kick, you know, outlook and information and a new experience that can lead you to looking in a different area.
Does this qualify if you're on unemployment and you get some cash through their training program? Does this qualify as a job training program?
Well, it doesn't qualify. I mean, it's like not under the stimulus package. It's not like one of those clear job training programs. No, but it is something that there could be parts of it. You have to check with your tax person. Parts of it could potentially be tax deductible, so you have to look into that. But I think it's more of an experience. They're seasonal jobs. If you go to a skiing area and you love to ski and you need to earn earn a chunk of money, this might be the time to do it. Again, it's sort of like we've talked a lot about seasonal jobs, internships. It beats the alternative for a lot of people of not doing anything. And the point is, and we're going to have it on the website, there are a lot of organizations that offer these for a lot less money than I think people would think. And it offers you something to do in this very tough environment.
Okay, and Mike actually did kind of end it. I mean, it's a little bit related to Mike and your job with the Department of Energy, a little bit. He's a program analyst at the Department of Energy now. He joined us from Washington, D.C. And Beth Koblainer, of course, our takeaway contributor. We do have links on our website so you can check out all the vacations available.
And if you had a chance to swap during your vacation to try out a dream job, what would you do? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. And six words or less, the State of the Union. Damien has this one. We need to start from scratch. Liz says, let's hear nothing but the truth, referring to the Obama State of the Union speech coming up on Wednesday. And Steve writes, throw out the bums, but which? Give us your take at thetakeaway.org, or you can recite it to us in a minute or less, six words or less, you decide, 877-8-MY-TAKE. And you can also go to our website and see some of those photos we were talking about. Very, very disturbing images coming out of Haiti. What do you think of them? That's at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.